Mr. Niels.
Morning, Your Honor. My name is John Niels, and I represent the appellant Abdul Karim Kanu in this tax appeal. The chart, which formed the centerpiece of the government's case, contained, we submit, two major errors warranting reversal of the conviction in this case. The first, and I propose to take them up in the same order that we did in our brief. The first error had to do with $1.9 million of corporate funds that the government contended had been diverted by Mr. Kanu to his own personal use in the year 2003. We submit that that money was, as a matter of law, not taxable income to Mr. Kanu, whether he diverted it or not, because before the end of the tax year 2003, he neither had the money nor did he make any claim to it. Instead,
where was the money found? This was cash money, $2 million, or $1.9 million, right?
Yes, it was found in his home. It was seized by the IRS from a safe in his home.
From a safe in his home. Now, suppose that it had been found in a safe in his home in an envelope that said to his wife, "Sweetie, take this and buy us a new place in the Bahamas." Would that have been enough? Could the jury then have convicted him on this count?
No, Your Honor. It would have meant that the money would properly have been treated as income to him, but under the long line of cases that we cite in our brief, if the money is returned before the end of the tax year to the proper owner, then there is a reduction from income in the amount of the money returned. And we cite two cases, Your Honor, that apply this doctrine of returned money to circumstances just like this, in which the money has been returned to a third-party custodian who is holding the money for the benefit of the rightful owner. There's the Mays case, in which the New York City police caught the embezzler, and the embezzler returned $10,700, and it was being held by the police before year end for the benefit of Bates, who was the victim.
What act of returning did the defendant take in that case?
In that case, the police caught him and they asked him to, where's the money, and demanded that he give it to him. He had some of the money left and he turned it over.
Mr. Niels, did you make this argument below to the district court?
Yes.
As a matter of law, you made this? I thought there was a factual argument you made.
No, that's what the government says, and they're incorrect. There was always a factual argument, which Mr. Kanu made below, and we make it again here, that he did not convert the money to his own personal use. But both below and here, we argued that even if he had indeed converted the money to his personal use, it was nonetheless, as a matter of law, not taxable income to him. And below, that argument was made, and the following reason was given. Here, the $1.9 million cannot be included in Mr. Kanu's net worth at the end of 2003 because it had been seized by the government in October of that year and then applied to the corporation's tax liabilities. That's at Appendix 104. And at Appendix 103, I'll read again a quote from our papers below. Even if one accepts the theory that Mr. Kanu attempted to divert the funds for his personal use, the amount should not be included in the cash expenditure calculations regarding Mr. Kanu's personal tax returns. And it was argued at A66, as a matter of law, the government should not be able to use this amount in its calculations. This was a serious motion that was made below.
He was convicted of attempted tax evasion, right?
Yeah, that's the only kind of tax evasion there is. That's what the title of 2672.01 says attempted tax evasion. So anytime there's a tax evasion, it says attempted tax evasion. This was not a tax evasion punishable or alleged in, under some special law. I'm sorry, I didn't let the court finish the question.
Well, that's okay. I did find what you said interesting. But I guess I don't see any logical inconsistency between attempting to evade tax and then because he is apprehended and returns the money and becomes corporate income and the corporation pays the tax. So I don't see any inconsistency between his attempting to evade the tax and it not being income to him as of the end of the year.
Here's the problem, Your Honor. One of the essential elements of the crime of tax evasion or attempted tax evasion, one of the essential elements is that there be a tax due and owing, sometimes referred to as a tax deficiency. For example, in this case, the trial judge instructed the jury. Element one is an act of evasion. Element two is willfulness. Element three, I think I'm giving them the wrong order, but the important element is that there has to be a tax due and owing. There has to be a tax deficiency. And that arises upon the filing of a return. When the return is due, if the return doesn't report the taxes that are due. And what we're saying is under this long line of cases, there is no tax due and owing for the year 2003 if the funds have been returned back to the benefit of their proper owner before the end of that tax year. That's what all of these cases stand for. And the original one, James, of course, was a criminal case. And what James says is that, yes, for the first time they held that embezzled funds are taxable. Before that, there was a Supreme Court case that held that they weren't because of the obligation to return it. The Supreme Court in James said, no, the fact that there's an obligation to return it doesn't change the fact that you get the money and you get beneficial use of it, and so you have to pay taxes on it. But the court in James said if it's returned to the proper owner, there is then a reduction in the amount of tax due and owing.
But it was not returned here, right? I mean, the police took it from his, their police, the agents took it from his safe, right?
Yes.
In his home.
Yes. Right. This is so not, this rule.
He did not make any act of returning.
Well, he did, actually. He made the one act that he could have made.
Held his hands up while the agents took it? Or?
No. He sent in an affidavit before the end of the year informing the IRS, these are corporate funds, not mine. And the doctrine that money isn't taxable if it's been returned before year end is not a reward for good behavior. It is simply a recognition of the fact that before year end, the person doesn't have the money anymore. The victim does. And under James, that means that there's no tax due. The almost all of these cases, not every one, but almost all of these cases that we rely on involve situations in which the person got caught. And whatever restitution was made because they got caught. Another case, for example, is the Hahn case.
Is there anything in the affidavit?
I beg pardon?
Is there anything in the affidavit suggesting he's returning it?
No, he wasn't returning it then because the money had been taken and was in the custody of the IRS. Mm-hmm. But there's nothing.
When he enters into an agreement that it's the corporation's money, right? And that the it could be used for the corporation's tax liability.
The government sort of, but what happened, the sequence of events is he sends in the affidavit that before year end saying this money belongs to the corporation. And as a consequence of that, the IRS treated the money as corporate money and handled it for the benefit of the corporation. Another case, and this may be the case most closely in point and the most important one because is the Hahn case. And that decision was handed down in 2002. It is the most recent in time of any of the cases that we rely upon.
Which case is that?
H-A-N.
H-A-N.
And
it is a principal case in your brief.
I beg pardon?
Not indicated to be even a principal case in your brief.
And it's not a criminal case, and it's a tax court case. Is that the right one?
Tax court.
It's discussed at great length, and I can't explain why it's not asterisked.
I've never understood why we had the asterisk anyway. So.
Well,
here at 31.
Apparently I messed up on the asterisk, but the case is discussed, it quoted at length in our brief, and the facts are described in our brief. It is very close.
It's not a criminal case, right?
No, but remember, the point that I've been making is that there has to be a tax deficiency or else you fail one of the elements of tax evasion. And consequently, what that
we
means...
We have a case in our circuit or in the Supreme Court that says you can't have a jeopardy assessment situation turned into an attempted evasion for criminal purposes.
I don't know the answer to that. Yeah. I
you don't know of any controlling precedent on this point then, right?
Not on the point that you just raised, but there's a huge body of precedent that says, that would have said to a taxpayer on April 15th, when my client had to file his return, that this wasn't income, did not need to be reported on the return, and there would be no tax due and owing on it anyway. And that means you can't have tax evasion or attempted tax evasion under the case law that we rely upon. All of tax evasion depends on civil tax law, because unless you've got a tax due and owing, you don't have tax evasion. And the Hahn case is very close to our case. It's the last case before my client filed his tax return, and it's the last case in this line that is cited in either of the parties' briefs.
Now, on direct parallel cases, that is to say criminal attempted tax evasion cases, where there has not been a completed year or where there has been money seized, what is your closest case to this? Now, Hahn may be close in some respects, but on factual parallels to this case, what is your closest case?
Well, I believe the Hahn case is the closest
assume
case.
Assume that I don't believe that.
Okay.
What
well,
would be
I,
your next best case?
I'm
not asking you to back off of that position.
Okay, I understand.
I think you're going to understand that I don't think it is a controlling precedent or a parallel case. So give me one that's the closest. Is it May, or what is the case that's closest?
May's is a pretty close case, yes. I mean, we rely on all of the cases that we cite stand for the proposition that, in effect, when there is a return during the same tax year of some of the funds, that the tax is imposed on the net amount, the amount embezzled less the amount returned. That there's case after case after case that say that. And the reason I was citing the Hahn case is that it also involves a situation in which there was no, or at least some of the money was not voluntarily returned or even returned by act of the person who misappropriated the funds. The funds were in an account in his personal name and I believe it was his brother's name, and a TRO was slapped on the account. And the court held that the amounts that were under the custody of a third party pursuant to the TRO were not taxable to him because they were not, they had been,
is your,
he lost control of them was the exact language.
Is there argument that this is not income to him if it's returned in the same year that it's diverted? Or is your argument about the timing of when he loses control of it?
I believe the best way to read these cases is if you divert money to your own personal use, it's income. If you return it, you get a reduction in your income. and they offset each other. And so what you have to report at the end of the year is the amount not returned. That's what these cases say.
I think you and I have been failing to communicate on the name of one case. When I said May, you were talking about Mays. There's a United States v. May case in your brief. There's a Mays versus Commissioner case.
Yes.
May is a criminal case. Is there a criminal case that speaks to this point that is the closest? Is it United States v. May or United States v. What is the closest one to this point that deals with the criminal liability?
We rely exclusively, I think this is an answer to the court's question, we rely exclusively on cases that hold as a matter of civil tax law, there is no tax due or owing.
So you don't have one that applies that in the criminal context that is parallel to the case we have today. Is that correct?
Other than James itself, which is a criminal case, and in which the court said that there would be a reduction in income for monies returned. I would love to address my second point. I think I've said what I can say on this point. The second point relates to starting cash on hand. This is a critical element of any tax evasion case proved by this method. The starting cash on hand number that is critical in this case is the one at the beginning of 2002. This is shown on the chart, which is reproduced at page 18 of our brief. And the critical number is the one in yellow under the heading 2002, and it's $65,000. This is a crucial number in this case because it is an axiom of the cash method of proof that the government must prove starting cash on hand to a reasonable certainty. Otherwise, its evidence is insufficient to go to the jury. The reason for that is it flows from the corollary proposition that the government must do a thorough investigation that excludes the possibility that the expenditures in 2002 and 2003 were paid for out of cash accumulated in prior years. And this is where the cash accumulated in prior years could be non-taxable income or it could be unreported taxable income. There are three cases we cite in our brief that stand for that proposition. So this is where the case gets interesting. The government did do an investigation resulting in an indictment, and the indictment alleged that in the 3 years leading up to 2002, Mr. Canoe received skimmed taxable income that he didn't report on his tax returns. Each one of those years, the indictment alleges he had that money coming into him. And that obviously would have added to his cash supply at the beginning of 2002. But then look at the chart. The chart is based on the assumption that he got no income, that he had no skim cash in those years. One clue to that is to look at the numbers highlighted, the zeros highlighted in blue on our chart that denominate the total unreported taxable income in 1999, 2000, and if you look at net cash expenditures, which are zero in 2001, the chart has been prepared on the assumption that he got no unreported taxable income in those years and no skimmed cash. Instead of skimmed cash adding to his cash on hand, what you see instead in the line marked in yellow is that his cash on hand that he started with in 1999 of $700,000, you see that being dissipated. That's going down. This is completely inconsistent with what the government...
Is this an argument of law or an argument of fact?
Well, it's an...
It sounds a lot like things that I used to say to juries in tax cases, Mr. Neals. I'm not sure this is something that is for the court on appeal. I'm sure you made this argument in the district court.
No, this argument was not... This exact argument was not made in the district court. And what it goes to, it's an argument of law because, as I said a moment ago, unless the government excludes the possibility that the expenditures in the indictment years were paid for out of funds accumulated before the indictment years, unless they exclude that possibility, the case cannot go to the jury. Indeed, the Black case, which I wrote a letter to the panel about before argument, this court in dicta is saying exactly that. That it's a question of insufficient evidence. So what we're dealing with here is a question of insufficient evidence. The government has now in its brief reaffirmed the position that Mr. Canoe was skimming all through 99, 00, and 01. And yet that is shown nowhere on this chart. Now, we're not saying he did. We're not saying he didn't. What we're saying is you can't possibly regard the $65,000 starting cash on hand in 2002 as having been established with reasonable certainty, given that the government has states to this day that it believes Mr. Canoe was adding to his starting to his cash for in 1999, 2000, and 2001, and that is shown nowhere on this chart.
Where do they say that?
I beg pardon?
Where is that statement by the government?
It's at the government's brief at page 16. The government says, the government consistently asserted that appellant had skimmed money from his corporations from 1999 through 2003, and the government's evidence at trial supported this assertion. But it is nowhere on this chart. This chart is prepared under the assumption by the IRS agent that testified. It's prepared under the assumption that there's no unreported skimmed income received by Mr. Canoe in 1999, 2000, and 2001. And that is the only way that the government gets to show all this cash on the yellow line depleted all the way down to $65,000.
In context, that statement by the government is contrary to your contention. We, the government, have consistently asserted that appellant had skimmed money 99 to 03. And the evidence at trial supports this assertion. And you're saying, well, it's not in the chart, so it is not consistent. They have not consistently done that, correct?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
It's not in the chart.
Oh, absolutely. We said that in our brief.
And I understand. And what do you have any specific evidence as to the magnitude of this omission?
No, we do not know, and neither does the government. If there was $700,000 that was skimmed in those years, it would mean that this $65,000 figure is understated by $700,000. If it was more than that, it would be understated by more than that.
The evidence adduced and underlying the indictment, which had many more counts, of course, was based on the testimony of a witness who's since fled. And that testimony deals with fairly modest amounts, a few $100,000. So it's not clear to me whether, unless there's reason to think, or the government at one time had reason to think, which it's now ignoring, that there was more than $700,000 skimmed in those years, it hasn't failed to account for anything.
Well, Your Honor, maybe this is a helpful way to look at this problem.
This is his former business partner, right?
I beg pardon?
We're talking about his former business partner.
Yes, there was that testimony, mm-hmm. The government claimed that their trial evidence also supported this. And here is a way to look at it, and I think this will be helpful to the court. If you look at 1999, 2000, and 2001, on this chart, in each of those years, the expenditures, which are above the yellow line, exceed by significant amounts the cash sources, which are below the yellow line. In other words, put the starting cash hoard of $700,000 to one side for the moment, and you will see the cash outflows significantly exceed the cash inflows for each of those years. Now, what that means is that there are two inferences that can rationally be drawn from that fact. Inference number one is that the difference, the delta, is made up, is explained by skim cash. That's what the government normally tries to infer in situations like this. There's a second inference that can be drawn, which is it's explained by the starting cash on hand, the hoard of $700,000. And we don't know which is true. The
what
government,
was the
however,
evidentiary base for the $698,000 figure. What was the evidentiary base for the $698,886.20?
It was a financial statement submitted by Mr. Canoe to the lessor of the nightclub space that he was about
right.
to lease.
Right. So what's wrong with that figure?
Well,
this is a net worth and expenditures case, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So they started with his own statement of his net worth that he had used in a financial transaction, right?
For the moment, I wasn't quarreling with that at all, Your Honor.
Yes.
What I'm saying is the problem is it's being shown as depleted. The government has assumed that all of the excess cash expenditures in 99, 00, and 01 are explained by paying down the $700,000, and zero of it is explained by skimmed cash. The government had no evidence of skimmed cash, Your Honor, in 2002.
That's only one piece of the calculation, though. You've got all the cash withdrawals, the unknown checks, all the rest of the calculation. I'm not trying to be disagreeable with you. I'm just not quite following you. That's one line that shows there is a reduction in cash on hand, and I don't know how we can take that one line and come to the conclusion you're coming to that there was insufficient evidence.
What the government has to do is establish to a reasonable certainty the accuracy of their $65,000 number. What I'm suggesting is there's no way in the world you can say that number has been established to a reasonable certainty when the government has alleged in its indictment and maintained up to this day that he received skim cash in 1999, 2000, and 2001, and that skimmed cash is not shown on this chart at all. And indeed, the chart contradicts the allegation in the indictment, contradicts it.
We've taken you well beyond your allotted time. Unless my colleagues have further questions, we'll hear from the government, and we'll give you back a couple of minutes for rebuttal after.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Catherine
Morning,
Kelly.
Ms. Kelly.
Catherine Kelly on behalf of the United States. Your Honors, starting with the cash on hand number, as Mr. Connor's attorney has just said, the $700,000 number came from his very own financial statements. And the government's investigation did not end there, and that's why the government did prove that number, that starting cash on hand, both in 1999 and all the way through 2002, 2003, with reasonable certainty. As Agent Lewis...
Does the government show any additional cash receipts received by the defendant in 2000?
In 2000, under the top of the cash expenditures chart, there were additional cash deposits of approximately $95,870. And there was additional sources of cash under the sources of cash columns below for the year 2000, starting with the 79,000 number going on downward to the $127 of interest income.
All right. Does that or anything else on here reflect cash skimmed during that year?
As we argued in closing, we argued that cash skimmed could be seen in a number of the items in 2000 under the cash expenditures, the cash deposits into Chevy Chase Bank, for instance, and the cashier's checks purchased with cash. But I think the important thing to remember about the cash method of accounting is the reason that you're not seeing particular amounts of skimmed cash is because you use this indirect method of accounting when it's unclear when these amounts were skimmed. By its very nature, if you're running a cash business and you're skimming cash from it, it's going to be near impossible to tell exactly when and what amounts the skimmed cash is taken, so which is why you use an indirect method of proof in the first place. And moreover, frankly, the fact that the government started with a $700,000 cash on hand number here is why you're not seeing amounts of unreported taxable income until 2002, because how the cash method works is you only see that unreported income where the cash expenditures in the given year exceed the cash sources in that year.
Well, I understand that, although I must say it is difficult to keep this method clearly in mind, but I do understand that. My question is to try to clarify it is, whether if the government alleged that he was skimming cash during those years, it shows up anywhere in this chart.
Well, it shows up in the places that I mentioned under cash expenditures when there was some documented evidence of money which were cash deposits into his bank accounts. However, the reason that you don't see it actually showing up, the cash skimmed as under the unreported income, is because you only infer that the excess amount of cash expenditures in any given year is unreported income when it exceeds the sources of cash you have, including that $700,000 starting cash on hand. So essentially, by starting Mr. Kanu with $700,000 of cash on hand, given his other money and his cash expenditures, because you're not looking at anything except the excess amount of unreported income, ultimately, he got the benefit of having all that cash in his possession at the beginning, and he had to run through all that cash before any unreported income showed up. So he essentially got a windfall from 1999 through 2001.
That seems counterintuitive. As I thought you were saying before, he could have also supplemented that cash each year.
Which he did, but it's important to note, and I think that the main problem here is that there has been some confusion. Under the cash method, if you, quote-unquote, supplement your funds with skimmed money, it's never going to go under that source of cash or cash on hand part of the columns. It's going to go under the cash expenditures part of the chart. So you'd only, if you're skimming money under the cash method, it's only going to show up as a cash expenditure. So every time you would be able to report some sort of skimmed funds, it's going to count against the cash.
Well, that may
on
be
hand.
The reason that the Supreme Court has been so insistent on an exhaustive negation of alternative sources.
That's correct, which is exactly what happened here. You started out with Mr. Kanu's own financial statements, which...
Yeah, I know what you said, but you also had testimony that from his former business partner involving several hundred thousands of dollars, right? That saying he, in 97 and 98, invested $300,000 in a nightclub, okay? And was repaid in 98 with 20% or 25% interest on that.
Those were loans taken. I'm sorry, is that Mr. Dean's testimony, Your Honor?
Melly's.
Saleh Melly's? I only ask because
yes.
Saleh Melly's did not testify at trial. He was.
No, this is grand jury testimony.
Right.
And this initially, your indictment, I believe, reflected this.
There were certain loans that were taken from the corporations and given back.
Reflected this skimming in those years.
1997?
Yeah, let's see.
I don't believe that any monies that were loaned by the corporations were counted as skimmed cash, because there was documentation of those loans, there was loan repayments and so forth. So I don't believe the government at any point was saying that.
But then it says he made 20 or 25% interest on that, and then, according to Melly's, continued to get a share in cash of the profits of the nightclub.
Which would essentially be a wash as far as the chart goes. There was no argument that the government was making that he was skimming that cash in 1997 and 1998.
I understand that, but the question is, what have you done to negate that possible additional funds? At one point, you thought he had cash coming in those earlier years. I guess you want to say now, well, that's part of the $700,000.
It's either part of the $700,000, or they're talking about loans that were made to the corporation and then paid back and so forth. So that's not really
a continuing flow of profits. It's according to this testimony.
And
in cash,
we would say then that money comes in into the $700,000 then. And as Agent Lewis testified, he looked at 21 different types of potential sources of cash during the years in this chart. And where he found them, they were included in the chart under sources of cash. And where he found cash expenditures, those were included as the sources of cash. And ultimately,
when you say that when it's 21 sources, you're talking about things like gifts, inheritance,
correct,
and so on, right?
Correct.
So what did he do about skimming?
The skimming shows up in the cash method of proof and on this chart, particularly under the unreported taxable income, because
what did the investigator do to deal with the possibility of additional cash sources in the form of skimming? Negate gifts and something to negate inheritance, right?
Right. He didn't find any gifts, no evidence of inheritances.
Right.
Again, the skimmed money, if there was any, would be accounted for in the cash expenditures column. It would never go to increased sources of cash.
As I understand it, that would be the number that would be left after you got through accounting for the possible legitimate sources of non-taxable cash. What you would have left if you had cash would be the skimmed cash.
The jury is allowed to infer, because again, it is a factual question, if the cash expenditures exceed the cash sources during the period in question, that can be inferred to be the excess amount.
And that would be where the skimming would be.
And that's where the skimming would be. This is what Agent Lewis' testimony was, that the likely source of that unreported income in 2002 and 2003, again, was the nightclubs. So that's where we are there. But it's very clear here that the government did a very thorough investigation. It examined every piece of paper they seized from the nightclubs and from Mr. Kanu's home and came up with this chart. And the reason that there's no unreported taxable income in 1999 through 2001 is because simply the amount of cash on hand and his other cash sources at that time still exceeded the amount of cash expenditures that would include skimmed funds. So he's not showing any unreported income until he runs through that $700,000 and whatever additional money he has as cash sources in those 3 years. So for that reason, we strongly assert that there was a reasonable certainty established as to the starting cash on hand.
Do you have more on that line, or can we ask you to move to the other point?
In turning to the other point, I think, first of all, it's very clear that this is not an issue that was raised, this James line of cases, not an issue that was raised until the time of sentencing. So we would assert that is definitely a plain error argument here. It was never argued as a basis at trial. If the court looks carefully at the filings that were cited in the defense argument, pages A66 and A103, and also page 104, it's clear that the defendant was arguing that it was the closing agreement between the corporations and the IRS that formed the basis of his argument that the money, the $1.9 million, shouldn't be considered in the year 2003. He didn't mention the James line of cases until sentencing, which is much more than citing an extra case in your brief. It's an entirely different line of argument. And what we say to that ultimately is that it was proper for the district court to admit the evidence of the $1.9 million seized from the appellant's home in October of 2003, because that's ultimately a question for the jury. That is what the jury was instructed. In fact, during Agent Lewis's testimony at two different times, between pages A108 and A110, I believe that's the 19th of November, which is actually pages 108 through 111 of the 19th transcript. The jury was instructed at least twice that Agent Lewis was testifying as to why he had chosen to put the $1.9 million into the 2003 column, but that the jury could reach its own conclusion as to whether or not those monies were properly placed in 2003, and it was up to the jury to decide whether or not they were going to accept Agent Lewis's explanation for why he put the money there. The final instructions also told the grand jury, or told the jury, that if the jury had decided that the defendant's cash expenditures exceeded his known sources of cash, then the jury needed to proceed to decide whether or not the evidence also established beyond a reasonable doubt that such excess cash expenditures represented taxable income. So ultimately, that's why it was properly admissible. Those are all questions for the jury to decide, which it did in this case. And I think it's also important for the court to note that ultimately this is harmless error anyway, even if there was some sort of error in putting the $1.9 million into the 2003 column, because you had that only affected the 2003 calculation. It didn't affect the 2002 tax evasion conviction. And it also, according to Agent Lewis's testimony, he said that even if I remove that $1.9 million from the column of 2003, the defendant still had unreported taxable income of approximately $300,000, on which $75,000 of taxes was due and owing. So there, even without the $1.9 million, the government had proven its tax deficiency, which is what you needed to prove in order to show tax evasion.
Would it affect, I'll come back to that in a moment, but would it affect sentencing? The amount of evaded unreported income, did that affect the sentence in this case?
No, it didn't, because under the guidelines, as we argued in our briefing, under the guidelines under Section 2T1.1C, you look at the what was the object of the offense, what was the amount of total loss that was the object of the offense, meaning what's the loss that would have resulted had the offense been successfully completed. If the IRS had never come in October and had never found that money at that time, that same jury or that same sentencing instruction, 2T1.1C5, says the tax loss is not reduced by any payment of tax subsequent to the commission of the offense. And again, contrary to what the defendant is arguing in his brief, there was an offense here even without the $1.9 million because as, under Agent Lewis's testimony, you still had $75,000 of tax due and owing even if you removed the $1.9 million. So
I didn't understand how it could fail to affect the range of the sentence.
Because
could you go over that again, please?
Sure. Ultimately, under 2T1.1C1, you calculate the tax loss as the total amount of loss that was the object of the offense, which is the loss that would have resulted had the offense been successfully completed. So here, if, according to the government's theory, which was very consistent...
If you take out the 1.9, then it's a smaller amount for that calculation.
No, my point in mentioning taking out the 1.9 was in the defense briefing...
No, my point in asking you about the 1.9 is if you take that out, then it's a smaller amount for sentencing calculation.
No, and that's what I'm saying. I'm saying with or without the $1.9 million, there's still a tax offense, which is...
I'm saying for the sentencing calculation...
And for the sentencing
calculation... You are listening to us, are you not, counsel?
No, I am listening.
For sentencing calculation, you just said that the object is material. The amount's material, right?
That's right, and we would argue...
And if it's less, it's reduced by $1.9 million, why would that not change the range?
Well, our point is that the total amount of loss would include the $1.9 million.
My question is, if it doesn't include the $1.9 million, it does affect the range.
Then it would, right? It would affect the sentencing range.
Right. And so if... Go ahead.
Are you saying that somehow if the $1.9 million were not part of the offense of conviction, it would still come into the sentencing?
Yes, it would, because the court made very distinct factual findings at sentencing and credited Agent Lewis's testimony, discredited the argument the defendant had made at trial that the $1.9 million was really corporate money that all came from a Howard Homecoming event in October 2003, and held that the $1.9 million was nightclub proceeds that should have been reported by the corporations and by the defendant. So all those factual findings were found at sentencing by the trial court. The government proved the offense, and properly, the court calculated the tax loss as including the $1.9 million at sentencing. And ultimately,
counsel made a very eloquent argument in the brief and orally that where the money is not successfully evaded because the year ends, or the money is taken before the year ends, rather, that it is not then money on which there has been a tax evasion. If he were right about that, then the money would not be included at the sentencing phase, would it?
No, but what you need...
I'm not asking you to admit he's right. He may or may not be right.
No,
but
I completely disagree, actually. With
you do? Okay. Even if he were correct about that, you would still count the $1.9 million?
At sentencing, yes, because according to the sentencing court's findings, the court found that the $1.9 million was nightclub proceeds and that it should have been reported by the defendant and by the corporations. And on that basis, given that 2T1.1C1 is controlling, then we would say that that tax loss does include the $1.9 million, regardless of the other issues in the case. I think it's just important to note, if the court doesn't have any further questions, is that the government maintained a completely consistent position throughout this case in the indictment.
Okay. What do you say to the base proposition about the $1.9 million, that it should not have been included because it was properly taxable to the corporation and it was taken back before he had a chance to complete the evasion on it, if that were his intention, as a personal taxpayer?
The point is...
The issues that counsel sets and the argument counsel made.
What I say to that was a question for the jury to decide at trial. It was clear that the jury accepted the government's theory of the case and as to the tax evasion in 2002 and 2003, and that it was the jury's decision to decide whether or not that
$1.9 says that's not a jury question. He says that those cases that he sets underlie a proposition that this is a matter of law.
Well, the point is, it was a jury question. The jury was instructed.
Don't just tell me that it was. Tell me why I should think it was.
Because that's how the cash method works. It's up to the jury to decide.
What's your best case for the proposition that this is a matter of law and not fact? I mean, matter of fact and not law.
Matter of fact and not law is ultimately the Tushin case that talks about...
Which case?
Tushin, T-O-U-S-H-I-N. It's 899 F second. They talk about the cash method of proof and ultimately that it's a jury question. It's a question for the jury as to when the defendant controlled the money. And it's on page 623 of the Tushin case. It's up to the jury to determine when an individual has exercised the dominion and control over the funds that would justify imposing tax liability on him. So it was up to the jury in this case, and therefore that evidence was properly admitted. It was up to the jury to decide whether or not that money properly belonged in 2002 and 2003. And again, our point is, even if you take out that $1.9 million, he still has $300,000 of unreported income and $75,000 tax deficiency for 2003. And that the 2002 conviction is not affected by that number at all. So therefore, even if the court was to say that there was some sort of error in including the $1.9 million in 2003, it's harmless. It doesn't affect his conviction in either case. But for purposes of trial, which really was the issue that the court was faced with at trial, that was a jury question. If the court has no further questions, I would respectfully request that the court affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Give me back 2 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just to pick up on the court's question, Tushin doesn't involve the situation of returned funds at all. It has nothing to do with that. And so it does not support the government's argument on the issue of whether returned funds are non-taxable as a matter of law. Judge Ginsburg, you asked whether the skimmed money showed up anywhere on the chart, and the answer is no, it doesn't. The amount of money below the line are all known sources. They're mostly stuff that Canoe reported on his tax return. And some of them are cash paychecks, but they're all known sources. They come out of banks or they were reported on his tax return. And
so this, you're referring to, what you're referring to includes cash expenditures, specifically deposits into various banks?
No.
Top of the chart?
No, I'm talking about the bottom of the chart, the sources.
Okay,
so it's not in there. And then what's happened, and you have to look at this closely to see it, but this is what's happening. The government, by doing this odd trick, has...
What odd trick? I'm sorry to interrupt, but...
I'll show you. Okay. I'll show you. What they've done is that they have explained all of these cash expenditures that are up at the top. That's the stuff that could be tax evaded money. They have purported to explain all of those by depleting the $700,000. They have no idea whether that is indeed what happened. They have no idea. It could easily be all of the stuff above the line was paid for with skimmed money, and that this $700,000 was never depleted at all. They have no idea. They have no proof one way or the other about that, and they have continued to maintain to this very day that Canoe was skimming income each one of those years. This chart simply does not add up. If you believe what the government asserts to be true to this very day, which is that Canoe skimmed income each one of those years. I want to get back to...
In response to that position, did you, in your brief, say, no, all these deposits into these three banks are accounted for by non-skimmed funds?
The deposits up at the top, do you mean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did we say... Right. They were accounted for by non-skimmed funds?
Yeah.
No, we say what we said very clearly in our brief is we don't know whether this is skimmed money or not skimmed money.
Well, your grievance was that under the sources of cash, they didn't list skimmed money. They have no indication that money was skimmed, except it seems to me that there might have been a lot of money in cash deposited into banks. Then you'd say to that, well, all that money was accounted for mm-hmm. as payroll checks and various other sources.
But I would like to articulate our argument a little bit differently. Our argument is that you cannot assume that the starting cash of $700,000 that is shown being depleted, mm-hmm. you cannot support that assumption. It's a guess.
But you call this an odd trick, and this really looks a lot like a fairly standard net worth and cash expenditures case. Because ordinarily the government is not going to have evidence of what the skimmed money is, except by the calculation of what other money there was and what expenditures were made. You're not going to have a line that says this is the money that he didn't record anywhere. That's going to be what's left after you get through accounting, and that looks like what's done here.
It does look that way.
Yeah, it looks just like any other net worth and cash expenditures case.
It does.
I grant you, I haven't seen one in a long, long time. We don't get many in this circuit, but I saw a lot of them many years ago, and I don't see anything odd about this.
It does look that way. The problem is that the years 99, 2000, and 2001 are not the tax evasion years.
Right.
And so it is crucial to know whether the starting cash on hand has in fact been depleted in those years or not. And if you treat the excess cash expenditures as being attributable to the $700,000 starting cash on hand, and you don't know whether that's true, but if you treat it that way, then it permits you as the government to reduce the amount of cash that shows up.
If you don't calculate that depletion, doesn't that make the case even worse? I mean, does it look like there's even more money being skimmed than if you do deplete it?
Here's what would have happened if you had followed their current theory of what happened, which is that Canoe was skimming in 99, 00, and 01. That should lead you to say not that he had zero unreported taxable income, which is what they conclude, but that the excess expenditures above the line, above the yellow, are accounted for by skimming. And if that's true, then you can't deplete this yellow line at all.
Okay, so what you're saying is it should show skimming in a different year.
It definitely would show skimming in a different year.
All right,
in the years barred by the statute of limitations.
In the year before the indictment, before the statute, right?
Before the statute.
I'm following you. Yep.
That's exactly it. Okay. And this is a crucial, thank you, this is the crucial point in the entire argument. Because, maybe a trick
I
was
don't
to,
think you said anywhere in the brief, we agree that he skimmed, but it was in a different year.
What we said was, we don't agree that he skimmed ever. Mm-hmm. We don't agree the 700,000 was accurate. But what we are saying is the government has the burden of proving starting cash on hand to a reasonable certainty. We think what we've established and what the government has established, if it really believes what it says it believes, is that this number of 65,000 is completely uncertain. It is completely plausible that the delta for 99.00 and 01 is explained by skimming, in which case there is no depletion of the 700,000 starting cash on hand. Mm-hmm. And that's the problem. This is just uncertain. The government has not excluded the possibility that the expenditures in 02 and 03 stemmed from skimmed income accumulated in prior years, or put another way, what's left over.
We've kept you up again beyond the allotted time, which should convince you that we are interested in your argument. So,
well, thank you. I was going to address the sentencing too.
One more line of questions from my colleague. I'm sorry.
What is your reply to the government's statement that even if the 1.9 million is excluded, the sentence would not be affected?
That's wrong.
Is that there's still 300,000 out there?
That's wrong. It would result in a 4-point downward adjustment, which would make the sentence outside of the appropriate guidelines. It's just wrong. And I would also say that if we are right that the 1.9, there was no tax due and owing. And if we're right, as I'm very certain we are, that if there's no tax due and owing, there's no evasion, then that 1.9 should not have been on the chart. The pretrial motion to exclude it from the chart should have been granted. And the prejudice to our client from having that money in the government's case and listed on the chart as tax-evaded money was enormous. It was the centerpiece of the government's case. They took pictures, photographs of the money, and showed it to the jury. They mentioned it 16 times in a 23-page summation.
You probably finished answering Judge Ginsburg's question a few closings back.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Thanks to the government. Case is submitted.